Welcome to the Floor Specifier Podcast. This is Brett Cyphers, and I'm joined today by my co-host and fellow members of the Specifier Editorial Board. First, we have Jeff Littlejohn. He's with National Stormwater Trust, On-Site Performance, and he's also a senior advisor at the Adams & Reese Law Firm. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you kindly. Next, there's Patrick Gillespie. Patrick is the Editor-in-Chief of the Florida Specifier and a Government Affairs Advisor with the Adams & Reese Law Firm. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Thank you for asking.
Our fellow editor, Ryan Matthews, can't be with us here today because, in addition to being a terrible person, he also has a commitment he just couldn't get away from. You have to trust me when I say it is actually more important than us. Hard to imagine. And there's me. I'm with Enfield Consulting, and I host another podcast under the Specifier banner called Water for Fighting. Gentlemen, it's great to be with you today. So as of this recording, we're about a month after the end of the legislative session here in Florida, and there's plenty to talk about there. There's also an immense amount of movement in the realm of rulemaking and other regulatory goings-on. But since you and Herschel Vineyard, former DEP secretary, teamed up to pen a fantastic article on 404 permitting in the March-April edition of the Specifier, let's start with you, Jeff. Talk a little bit about where the 404 controversy stems from, even what it is, and then about where we sit today.
Brett, this could be the subject of an entire podcast, so I'm going to try to just hit the Cliff's Notes version. The 404 program refers to the 404, Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, and it's a wetland regulatory program for federal jurisdictional wetlands. And the controversial part about this starts out with a judge in Washington, D.C., who vacated the state of Florida's authority to implement this program. And it happened, really surprised everybody that I know that was following the case closely. They were not expecting a complete, cancellation of the program. They were expecting maybe there would, be some defects that could be cured on remand back to the agencies. But it was a total stop everything order. Because of that, it meant that every application that was pending with the state was really, immediately put in limbo. So these are, more than 1,000. I've heard maybe 1,600 applications, from the Department of Transportation to Everglades Restoration to, schools and residential development. But you pick it. Every type of application that can be conceived of is in the pipeline, and that pipeline came to an immediate and screeching halt. So since then, and the Specifier, we've been covering this pretty closely on the website, so please continue to look there for updates. But since then, there's been filings of, from all the parties requesting relief from this. Those filings at this point have not been fully acted upon by the judge, and the result is that all of those applications are still on hold. So as recently as last week, there was another hearing before the judge. It appears that did not go well. The more this keeps going, and the longer this keeps going, the more likely it seems to me that this program is going back to the Corps of Engineers, and the DEP will have lost its authority. So that's going to open up a whole nother discussion about what that process looks like and how long that's going to take, and what does it mean for all these applicants that are stuck.
Let me ask you about something. Is it a sideshow? The U.S. House Representatives passed a resolution recently basically affirming Florida's right to do this, or that's where it belongs, is with DEP. Is that really just a sideshow? I mean, is there any chance that makes it to the Senate from things that you hear? Or?
Well, from what I'm hearing, it's a non-starter in the Senate. And I also understand, and I'm just reading this online, that President Biden has indicated that he would veto that if it were brought to him. So that would mean a veto override. It doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Any indication from sources that you may have that what happens in terms of, say, the order of March, if it's back with the Corps? If you recall, and I think everyone who had a permit at the Corps before it was assumed by the 404 was assumed by Florida the first time, was that it ended up being a giant mess. They threw it all at one time, ends up in a pile back in Florida, and you have to try to sift through and figure out how to triage the applications you have. Is there any sense of there being a method to any madness back at the Corps at this point?
I think so. I've met with and spoken with the leadership over in Jacksonville at the Corps of Engineers. They are indicating that they want to have an orderly transfer and that there's a lot of interest in, and they've even stated that they've established a tiger team to triage the applications that are being reverted back to the Corps. I'm encouraged by all the talk. The question will be whether that happens and how it goes.
That sounds good. And I'll definitely, even myself, but certainly everybody out there, keep an eye out for more of those updates on the specifier website.
And just one thing on that, one of the things just from an editorial perspective that I appreciated about this is we were one of the first news entities to even start talking about this. You know, it kind of broke overnight on a Thursday. We were up on it early. Our web traffic was kind of through the roof because people were craving information. And we've been updating this much more frequently than I think any other news entity out there. So the fact that we've got, experts and sources from DC all the way down to Tallahassee and throughout the state who have information about this, I think just shows that we're a news source that can handle this type of news.
It's funny you say that because I think we're turning a corner in terms of the specifier as an entity, and large part thanks to you is having components of what we do out there on a timely basis. You've got up-to-date newsletters, news as it breaks, especially on issues like this, I think is really important to have the bandwidth to produce information about it rather than just saying, oh, this is a thing that's happened, two sentences and you're done. So I say well done to both of you in that regard. Let's get back to session. And I say that because, Patrick, you wrote two articles in the most recent issue covering not just the budget, but also some policy highlights. Let's talk about the budget first, because everyone likes to talk about money. With a caveat, overlying almost everything that we're going to talk about here, being that the governor has yet to have his say, meaning decide what he's going to veto and what he's going to let go, we have a budget somewhere around that stout $117 billion. Environmental spending is not an insignificant part of that, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think the DEP sort of budget side of things was close to $10 billion. Normal assortment of different types of projects, got your water projects, and specifically calling out Everglades and Indian River Lagoon, petroleum cleanup program, land acquisition for all the Florida corridor spending and different things like that. So not an insignificant number at all. And certainly it seemed like throughout the process, not a ton of disagreement. I mean, obviously there's tweaking that happens, but it seemed like these numbers were settled on without a lot of fanfare.
Water projects are always an unknown. I deal with that directly in our firm here at Anfield, deals with that quite a bit directly. So there's a great big kind of void there that you're not sure what's going on behind the scenes, but I think you're right. I think the legislature was very responsive to the governor's recommended budget, with the exception of the normal highlight, which is the Everglades, meaning off in the South Florida Water Management District, getting an immense amount of money for work down there. I was struck by Florida Forever and land acquisition in general getting over $500 million, much of that being for one particular project that's important for the St. John's River Water Management District, and that's the Groveland Reservoir. And they got $400 million. And when you see numbers like that, typically you're talking about the Everglades. And so that, I thought that really stood out to me, in that sense. Let's talk about a component of it, and it's from Senate Bill 1638, which the governor has signed, and that deals with the Seminole Gaming Compact dollars and where that's supposed to go. The estimates are $750 million a year, somewhere in that.
I think minimum $400 million, the estimate is $750 million this year.
Talk about that breakout. This year, I guess it's a little bit less that they've actually identified in the budget. I think a lot of that is found in that Everglades portion of the budget. But the out years seem to be the most interesting to me in terms of where they're placing that money. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Yeah, so the bill was signed earlier this week, had a ceremony down at the South Florida Water Management District, and then there was a subsequent bill related to establishing the trust fund, which is really just back office work there. But highlights of the bill, so this is a 30-year compact, $2.5 billion guaranteed for the first 5 years. Not less than $400 million annually. And again, Florida Wildlife Corridor, land management, DEP, state park land management activities gets into even money for FDACs for some of their activities. So it's really interesting how, as this worked its way through the process, again, it seemed like not a ton of controversy throughout. I mean, I didn't see a lot of amendments, didn't see a lot of, certainly behind the scenes, I'm sure there was a lot of work that went on with it. But, you know, for the most part, it seemed like this was something that was going to happen, and it happened.
Are you surprised? I guess I'll preface by saying I am surprised that they would place the amount of investment they have, especially in the out years, on not just land acquisition dollars, but more importantly, land management dollars, because we have hundreds of thousands, a couple million acres of land, if you consider the state and water management districts and fish and wildlife all as one. And it seems like the short end of the stick is, how do you take care of all this property we're buying? And it seems like they're at least making really large stride in that direction. That surprised you as well?
Yes and no. I think it makes sense, right? It's logical that if you're going to continue to invest $500 million a year in buying land, you need to do something to manage it, right? You have to manage for forest fires and things like that. But it's logical. I also think it's a large amount of money. And so you've got to sort of figure out, we can't just spend these large figures in a single year. So you've got to figure out ways to spread it out and put it into different buckets for different issues. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's a clear indication that the environment and environmental spending was a priority of this legislature. And, you know, certainly the governor signed it pretty quickly upon it coming over. So it's a great bill. It's interesting how we've now got the lottery going to education and gaming going to environment. These are big numbers and certainly can end up being sort of a guide for other states who are dealing with this sort of thing.
We may have stepped all over, you know, an idea that you may have had in terms of what stands out to you in the budget. I know that you're not, by your very nature, a budget or a spending guy, but is there something in there that you looked at that caught your eye, Jeff?
Well, going back to the Seminole Compact revenue, that bill, something else that was very interesting to me is that it also created a mechanism to address funding gaps for water quality spending. So besides all the land management and land acquisition for the corridor and other designated, you know, categories of expenditure in there, the remainder of the compact money each year is earmarked for the Water Quality Improvement Grant Program. So there's a joke in here somewhere. I haven't quite put my finger on it, but it seems like if you can imagine that the money you put in for slots can come out as removing septic tanks. So as slots to septic, or so there's got to be a joke in there. I'm an engineer. I can't figure it out.
We'll have that update for you on the website, everyone, once he comes up with the correct analogy.
With a jingle, of course.
Yeah, we need a jingle for it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the huge parts is, and you're talking about the Water Protection and Sustainability Trust Fund and Program. And part of that is the alternative water supplies and the water quality improvement grants. And I think that's a huge item because those are subjects to a lot of recent laws that have been written, as well as rules that have been written. And up to this point, not a lot of money has been identified from the state's perspective to meet those needs. So I think you're absolutely right. That's an important addition to that allocation. Let's stick with you for another minute, Jeff, and go back to some policy. The legislature finally ratifies, they didn't manage to get it done last year, did this year, the statewide stormwater rule. I know you're going to, well, actually me for saying it like that, but can you give listeners and us the nickel tour of the final product?
Well, again, that's another meaty topic, Brett, but the statewide stormwater rule that was adopted back in 23 was amended during the ratification process. So that made it very interesting because it wasn't simply a ratification bill, but we were also observers of this rule. We're also evaluating all the amendments as they were filed in rapid succession during the various committee stops. The final product creates a couple of changes that are pretty significant. Most importantly, the ratification bill does delay the implementation of the new rule by 18 months. So I think that's the thing I would lead with anybody who's really concerned about this, is first and foremost, you have 18 months to figure it out. So if you haven't read the rule, you need to go read the rule. If you're not familiar with the changes that were made this session, you should definitely familiarize yourself with those. I think significantly the changes fall into kind of three categories. One is some additional categories of projects were grandfathered. And I think that was helpful to people who believed they had, you know, significant either investments in design or approvals at the local level, or maybe planned unit developments or things like that already had development density locked in or certain types of development locked in. The feeling that the new rule could affect that was a concern. So those a lot of those got grandfathered.
Talk for a second, you know, kind of in the midst of that, because there are some caveats to that gap, that period of time where before it actually goes effective, because there's a distinction there between having nothing and having a, what's considered, I'm using my quote fingers here, a complete application. Because some people are going to think, well, if I'm in the process or I've got an application in, that means that I'm good. But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, that's right. To continue to rely on the current version of the rule, your project application has to be complete within 18 months of the rule's effectiveness date.
And who determines if an application is complete?
Well, it depends on who you ask, and I'm not a lawyer, but could be the agency. You know, they may say you're not complete. We need more information. I think I've learned enough doing this enough years to know, I've been told by lawyers who are qualified to read statutes, that you can deem yourself complete. So it might be some interesting brinksmanship, you know, around the 18-month mark, the 17.9-month mark, where you have people submit a bunch of applications into the agency and say, we deem ourselves complete. We want to be grandfathered under the current rule. That'll be interesting. Let's talk about that. Let's put a pin in our calendar for 17.9 months from now.
Yeah, done. So in that vein, so we have a new statewide stormwater rule, ostensibly, again, with the understanding that the governor has not signed it, but he's going to sign this one. So that'll go effective. You have some other rules in statute, I'm thinking largely Senate Bill 712, House Bill 1379 over the last few years related to other various and sundry water quality issues, whether it be stormwater like this or wastewater treatment facilities. We've got some legislation that was passed and some rules being made right now that touch on those things. And I'm kind of fast forwarding myself into my favorite article, and I only say this because I think it's one of those necessary problem solver kind of bills. And we actually have an article in the paper written by John Fumero and Susan Martin, who we all know, who wrote a summary of House Bill 1073, which deals with mitigation and water quality enhancement areas, covering the need for more tools as it relates to not just the lack of mitigation credits to be found throughout the state, especially Southeast and Northeast Florida, but how do you solve problems in terms of the need for people in less and less real estate to work with to be able to deal with their new stormwater requirements? And I think it was a great, great article. I didn't know if you guys had any thoughts about it, but I'm interested in hearing what you think.
I thought it was a great article too. I was following this bill closely this year. I like the changes that were made on the wetland mitigation side. I'm also beginning to get a little smarter on the water quality enhancement area rulemaking. I'm in favor of more tools in the toolbox. So I'm a fan of the concept.
You have this bill passing, but you've got rulemaking right now. They said they've opened up rulemaking on water quality credit trading, which has been around for a while, as well as the water quality enhancement areas. And I guess that just stands out to me. It's like they've got to have these things if people are going to be able to comply with the new rule, with these laws. I think the work that you're doing, just, I mean, shameless plug for Stormwater Trust, is you're doing this work right now as well. And so having tools, people being clever and figuring out these problems, I think is a big part of moving forward, right?
I agree.
Since I gave up the game on my favorite article, Patrick, is there something in the paper you like the best? I mean, it's a hard question for you because the whole paper belongs to you and you actually wrote some. You can't pick your own.
So the two that stood out to me, one was related to septic tank legislation and how that's being implemented throughout the state. The other was related to a lot of hikes that customers have seen in utility rates. And the reason I like those is because both of those, I think, are issues that are kind of real to the everyday Floridian. They're things that they're seeing. And I also think it sets us up to continue to hit that topic as we move forward. Because I think certainly the legislation that came out last year related to septic tanks was kind of an overarching large piece of policy that will ultimately make a lot of changes throughout the state, particularly in areas close to impaired waterways and water bodies. And then utilities is just always something on on everyone's minds. And particularly with inflation, you see that you've got more and more utilities that are seeking to increase rates, but some of them are also receiving funds. And so you sort of have to kind of figure out and weed out, you know, why is this happening? And so I like those because I think those are interesting topics that I think apply to everyone in the state.
That'll end up becoming more and more important as you deal with these water quality issues where folks who were not necessarily in the wastewater business before that are getting into it, and then how do you deal with rate structures with people who are not accustomed to paying these bills? And so, yeah, I think it's a really good point. Jeff, in addition to your own article, what do you like?
So I can't claim my own article. I get that. I like the series that we've been doing. It seems like maybe this is the second paper we've done this with, the discussion around One Water that Dewberry's been doing. I like my friend Robert Beltran did a great job this paper with that article. I'm really interested in the initiatives that are being put forward by this coalition. Shameless plug, I've been listening in and hoping to participate on the coalition's efforts, and maybe we'll bring some legislation next year. I think there are definitely some opportunities to remove barriers between siloed regulations and help improve the way we manage and protect our water resources, and I'm interested in this area of policy. So I like the article, I like the series, I like the topic, and I also like Robert. So it's my favorite article.
Yeah, all true statements. Also, I like the idea of us doing more of that, which is these kind of thematic threads that run through not just, you know, one paper. And we'll talk about a theme coming up in an issue in the next couple of months. But the idea that we would take an issue like One Water and introduce it, have some content behind it, have some writing, and then tie a bow on it as something that moves forward. So I think that's really cool. Anything else?
Well, my favorite headline in the entire paper has to do with the Self-Defense Act related to bears.
I just thought
that's a grabber right there. Made me want to read it. That's it. That's all I got.
Crack bears. Read up on them.
That's right.
Yeah. More on that on the website as a crack bear epidemic unfolds. Before we go, let's hit a few calendar highlights, gentlemen. First, and these are things that you can find, by the way, in the Florida Specifier at floridaspecifier.com. Check them out. But a few calendar items for those of you out there in the conference season. The Florida Association of Environmental Professionals is holding its annual conference on April the 25th and 26th in Lake Buena Vista. That should be a really good one. It's a good organization. And then we have a serious sounding conference anyway, with the longest title I've ever heard of, the North American Hazardous Materials Management Association Southeast Chapter Conference. And that's May 6th to May 9th in Tampa. If that is your cup of tea, you will not want to miss that, I am sure. But most importantly, in looking forward, we have the biggest, most vital conference of the year for environmental policymakers and professionals, and that's the 38th Annual Environmental Permitting Summer School, brought to you by the Florida Environmental Network. Jeff, I understand you might know a thing or two about this one.
I've been to one before.
Have you? Me too. I know we'll have a special edition. Patrick, I want you to talk about that a little bit as we kind of tee up for that. Talk about summer school a little bit, Jeff, for those who don't know. We'll talk about it again, obviously. But just as a tiny primer to what that is.
Well, we're looking forward to another great group this year. I think we sold out all the hotel rooms faster than a Taylor Swift concert sells out of tickets. You know, we've got a great group. I think we're going to hit another record attendance this year, maybe in the 1,400 range. So it'll be a really, really good group. I think we've got 90, maybe 85 to 90 separate panels. You know, we're covering everything from growth management to resilience to water quality to, you know, you name the policy area, and we've got a course for it. So hopefully there's something there for everybody. I know it's hard to get a room there. I'm sorry. We need somebody to figure out a way to expand the JW Marriott down on Marco Island.
Done. I'll take care of it.
Okay. Get them as a client and get them another wing or something. We'll have just about the run of the place. So it'll be a great time. Jamie Sheehan, who's been handling all the logistics of that since Linda retired, she's done a great job. We got, all the speakers confirmed. We got confirmation from DEP that all their speakers are confirmed just today. Everything is looking great. It's lining up to be another great, another great event.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Bigger than Taylor Swift. And on that note, we're going to have a special edition for Marco Island. And so it's going to have a lot of great information in it. But there are also some opportunities from your perspective, from the paper's perspective, to get involved if you want to sponsor, if you want to, you know, record with the podcast while we're down there. There are opportunities like that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Don't know how I relate to Taylor Swift, but I'll take that as a compliment given her popularity. So for the special edition, as you said, so we kind of blow this one out just because we know that we're going to be bringing it to the conference. We know that there will be a high number of attendees at the conference. So what we, you know, attempt to do with this edition is just make sure it's extremely meaty, a lot of good content, a lot of interesting topics. Obviously, at the conference, you know, we're going to cover just about everything, everything that you could think of in the environmental realm. And so you're going to have top policymakers there. You're going to have kind of the top minds of these different areas. And so we're always interested in, obviously, advertisers who can get some additional exposure, but also story ideas. So things that, content that we want to try to push out, kind of like the One Water concept and some of these other conceptual ideas that different groups are coming together to talk about. We want to get those in because we want to get as many eyes on them as possible. So obviously that edition coming up in the July timeframe, we'll be looking here shortly for any of those ideas. And while I'm shamelessly plugging our new newsletter that we've put out over the last couple months, if you're interested in signing up for that, certainly go to the website, floridaspecifier.com. That's a weekly recap of different news that's coming out throughout the state. It's a great resource, free, also advertising opportunities there.
Yeah, and I would encourage people, if you have an idea for stories, please get in touch with Patrick, I believe is
Patrick@floridaspecifier.com.
You heard it right there. That includes stories, advertising, ideas for recordings like this. Whether it be in Marco Island or not, I encourage you to hit him up, and he'll get you to the right place. I think we got it all, guys, unless I missed something.
Just want to reiterate, Ryan is a terrible person.
And indeed. you ran out of whiskey.
I know. I apologize. But if Ryan had come, we wouldn't have enough. So on that note, thanks for listening to the Florida Specifier podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review, except for Ryan. If you don't like what you hear, it is, of course, Ryan's fault. And remember, you can just subscribe to the Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com and read your environmental news and commentary the old-fashioned way. But do be sure to subscribe, including the newsletter. It's easy, inexpensive, and offers a ton of ways to read, watch, listen, and learn at your fingertips. Your support is, as always, greatly appreciated. Production of the podcast is by Carl Sorn and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. And we want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. For Jeff Littlejohn, Patrick Gillespie, and the absent Ryan Matthews, I'm Brett Cyphers. And we'll see you next time.